Hello, and welcome to another Out and About podcast on Classical KUSC. I'm your host, Tim Grieving. Clinton Mansell is an outlier. He's blunt, British, formally untrained. He's a film composer who doesn't follow convention or kowtow. He's always been more of an auteur's composer than a populist, ever since he declared himself to Hollywood with a minimalist earworm score for Darren Aronofsky's Requiem for a Dream. Mansell grew up in an industrial area of England known as the Black Country because its skies used to be choked with soot. When he was nine, he was glued to his grandmother's TV watching Top of the Pops when David Bowie appeared to perform Starman. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He said, "I just remember a light went on." He never took a music lesson, and he taught himself chords from a thrift store guitar book. He left school at 18 and formed several bands, leading up to the post-punk group Pop'll Eat Itself. Rough justice, rough law. In 1996, after releasing five albums, he was ready for a change, which is right when the young Aronofsky invited him to turn his industrial, samples-heavy style into a film score for the movie Pi. Mansell went on to score Requiem for a Dream, Black Swan, The Fountain, and Noah for Aronofsky. He also scored the sci-fi film Moon for Duncan Jones, who just happens to be David Bowie's son, and just finished scoring Jones's upcoming film Mute. His latest score is for Loving Vincent, which comes out this Friday, directed by Dorota Kobiela and Hugh Welchman, the first fully painted feature film ever made. It's a murder mystery about Vincent van Gogh's final days, and it was shot in live action, and then every single frame was painted over in the style of Van Gogh by a team of 125 oil painters. It's an outlier project for an outlier composer.
So I talked to you last March, I think, for the LA Times.
Yeah.
And you were in the middle of working on the score, or you had just started. And you talked about how you said you'd sort of fallen out of love with movies a little bit. I think you were feeling a little burnt out.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some bad big studio experiences or something. Was Loving Vincent kind of a revitalizing or refreshing experience for you?
I think it's safe to say that if every creative process was like the one involved in Loving Vincent, I'd probably be a lot happier about, you know, my role in film work, I suppose, you know, because it was a true project of passion, you know, passion project. I'm really a bit early for me today. Dorota, who wrote and directed it with Hugh, you know, she started work on this 8 or 9 years ago, and it's just been something that she's pursued, and Hugh came on board encouraging her because it was going to be a short to start with, and he said it should be a feature, you know. You know, it's difficult for me not to respond to that sort of honesty, if you like, you know. It's made for a reason that this person wants to make it, not for, well, if we tweak it this way and tweak it that way, it'll play better here, it'll play better there, you know what I mean? All those sort of things are sort of like anti-artistic creativity to me, you know. I don't care if somebody gets it, really, you know. That's not the point. I grew up with, you know, watching films probably that I was a little too young for, but I'm talking about things like Nicholas Rogue, you know, his films say Walkabout or, you know, Don't Look Now, that, but those films challenged me, you know, and I still want that from movies, whereas a lot of movie making now is about pandering, and so that doesn't excite me, you know. But people doing their own thing is what it's all about, I think.
It's so different than a corporation making a product based on an existing product, which is what most major movies are these days.
Yeah, I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. I'm a big fan of the Marvel movies. You know, I grew up reading Marvel comics, and I love that world. And, you know, I'm the first one there when they're coming out. So, you know, I just don't want to work in that environment, really. Not too often, anyway.
So did they find you? Did they seek you out to score this based on work from your past?
Well, Dorota, the director and writer, she had written the script listening to my music. And
any specific scores?
The Fountain particularly.
Okay. That really works for the melancholia of this film.
Yeah. And she had said all the way through that that nobody else could score it except for me, you know, which was wonderful. But I didn't get that memo, and every time it sort of came across us. I didn't really understand what it was, and I guess I had other things going on, so I didn't pay too much attention, really. But this was like over a period of 4 years, something, you know, quite a long time. And I finally got to meet Ivan, who's one of the producers. I played a show in London at the Barbican 2014, and Ivan came, and that was when I first got a real sort of handle on what they were actually doing. But it wasn't until the following year, in the following August, when I met Dorota and Hugh, and they gave me the script. I read the script, and I saw the sort of rough take on what they were doing. I'm going, oh my God, this is amazing. Yeah, it was totally seductive, you know. And I mean, it is a, you know, it explores a lot of the things that I've liked in other films that I've enjoyed scoring, like, say, Moon or something, you know, or Black Swan or Pie, those sort of things where, you know, there's a slightly obsessive character that's got something they've just got to do, you know. And I guess, you know, it really sort of fit into my wheelhouse at that point, you know. And also as well, the tragedy of his life. I mean, tragedy if you think, you know, he never really got any recognition or reward or even just sort of an attaboy, if you like, for his work, you know. So I guess all artists can identify with people being blissfully unaware of what they are doing, if not negative about what they're doing, you know. So it's from an artistic point of view, it's almost like a universal story. We all know it, you know.
To talk a little bit about the style of it and how that influenced you.
Mm-hmm.
When you were scoring it, were you working with just the live action reference footage, or did you actually have some of the painted?
Well, when it started, it was mostly live action, but I wasn't really scoring. I was just using the time to be part of the film, absorb it, build ideas. The beauty of it is the fact that they shot the live action version and then they painted it. But what that meant was they had to lock the live action version because then they're going to paint it, so it's got to stay the same. So
that's a luxury these
days. An absolute luxury, you know. From, you know, I've got pretty much a locked picture for like 18 months or something, you know. So the beauty of that was I could write music for a scene that actually was still live action, but as the painting developed over it, I could use the development of the paint, the movement of the paint, the transitions from what, as something that could become part of the music. I could go back sort of 6 months later and go, okay, I can take this up a notch now because the look of the film has developed. I can now advance the music a little bit with it as well, you know. So it was, you know, fantastic really, because you've got this amount of time to experiment and see things grow and, you know, live with it and come back and work on it a bit more, which is very rare that you get that sort of time.
That's really unique.
In filmmaking, you know, to actually consider what you've done and go back and look at it and advance it based on everything else that's gone on in that time.
I mean, because it felt like the swirling quality of the score and just the textures. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are all metaphors anyway, but
right.
The textures in the score really suited the liquidy paint of the film. So how exactly did you work on a piece of music and then revise it based on the style of the paint?
Well, I mean, the opening of the film really is probably a big example. That actually didn't exist, because until we get to meet in the cafe and it starts with the fight, the whole opening really is sort of built on aesthetics of Van Gogh, if you like,
right.
You know. As that developed and those swirls came in, I could sort of go back and sort of, oh, well, the music can really sort of develop some life in it here, in the way that we perform to it and what we're trying to sort of match with it, the sort of blurry type of thing where that sort of feels like the sort of movement of the transition of the paints, you know. And that piece of music may have well been one of the first that I wrote. It was actually one of the last to be finished, because those opening titles and the movement were all, right, those were some of the last things to be done, you know. So through every step of it, you could sort of imbibe just a little bit more, you know, particularly, I say, with that scene, because then when we came to record it, we'd been talking about these, you know, movements and blurs and ideas of just this transitioning effect, if you like, this movement that you were seeing, this textural vibe, if you like. The time that we had was a massive part of that, you know. It just allows you to consider stuff and allow to breathe. And a deadline is always good to focus the mind, of course, and too much time can be actually as bad as too little time. Sure. But when you get your Goldilocks style and it's just right, you know, it really allows you to explore your ideas. And for instance, you know, obviously Van Gogh is Dutch, but he lives and dies in France, and the area that he's in at the time in Britain, the music that he would have been around him was very Gaelic influenced, you know. Now, to have gone with a Gaelic type score perhaps would have been a little confusing, because you're going, well, this guy's Dutch, he's in France, why does it sound like he's on Ireland or Scotland? But what we did instead of that was I took the instruments and used those, but not in their traditional sense, if you like. So it helped, hopefully gave a little bit of that flavour, but without sort of swamping it in it, you know.
Accordion and the like were colours you painted
with. There was a little bit, and, you know, obviously a fiddle, which is, you know, somewhat universal. But those sort of things, you know, that gave that texture
right
to what we were looking at, you know.
That sort of blurry, liquidy quality, is that just written? Like, did you just write in a certain way for strings to give it that, or did you process anything?
I mean, it's a mixture of everything, really, you know. Obviously, there are certain techniques when performing that can make things be less precise, for want of a better phrase, you know. I'm sure there's a technical term for that, which I'm not thinking of at the moment. But we didn't have a great deal of time on the recording stage for this film, because it wasn't a huge budget. But we could plan in advance so that, you know, we could try certain things. And if everything's working right, you know, you've got time to try these things, and then we can develop them after the fact in the mix and affecting them from there, you know. So, and also as well, the things that Jeff Foster, my recording engineer, does when we record, you know, I mean, things like the orchestra's in the room, but he'll also have, even if the piano's not being played, he'll have it in the room, he'll have it open and mic'd so that the strings vibrate with what the orchestra's playing, so you get this other quality in there, which can be mixed in or mixed out, and all these sort of elements can be dialed into to sort of get the, it might not be necessarily the effect we're looking for, but it sort of suggests the idea we're going after, you know.
Well, that, I mean, that sounds like the idea of like colors kind of overlapping or blending together or something, that these resonances,
yes,
in the room sort of,
yes,
mingling together.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the idea. So you know, you've got this sort of moving palette a little bit, if you like, so you get from, you know, the strains of one leading into another. You know, we end up with the score recorded, but elements that we can highlight and play with after the fact, if you like.
Well, I mean, on the surface, it does feel very at home stylistically, as we've talked about, with the swirling kind of quality. But then these themes that you talked about of depression and madness and melancholy, mm-hmm, and genius, mm-hmm, and artistic struggle, I mean, it feels very spiritually connected to some of these other scores of yours, like Noah or The, mm-hmm, Fountain. It does conjure these themes in a powerful way. Is it just a sort of an accident that you've worked on projects where those are the themes, or is something really resonant with you?
I think there must be something resonant about them. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I can only work on films that people offer me, but I sort of am looking for things that speak to me too, I suppose, you know, and whether I've had enough experience of doing this type of character, and so I just go, oh yeah, I can do that. I don't think that's it. It's just, like I said, with something like Moon, you know, Moon, you know, it's questioning like isolation, loneliness, what is it to be human, you know, and really it's a similar story. It's a similar, because like Van Gogh could have well been an alien from outer space, the way he was treated by people and the way he couldn't fit in. He couldn't make that connection with people the way he could make a connection with painting, you know, or drawing. And, you know, that to me is, well, you know, I think for somebody who suffers, say, with social anxiety and stuff like that, as well as sort of trying to, you know, create stuff, and, you know, you might have low self-confidence and whatever, you know, these are all real things that we, I know I deal with, and I'm sure a lot of people deal with, you know. So I get it, I think, you know, and I feel, I'm not saying I feel how he feels, but I can sort of relate to it. I want to work on things that speak to me and somehow bring something out of me, something that feels worth me spending 2 years doing it, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that I'd ever be asked to spend 2 years working on a Transformers movie, but I would feel like, what was that all about? I mean, unless they paid me, you know, billions of dollars, but it just wouldn't seem worth it to me. No offense, those things people enjoy them, and that's fine. I just don't want to spend my time in that way. So when I'm offered projects, I look for things that I'm going to go, yeah, this could be cool, you know. And obviously, the world's first oil-painted movie is, you know, particularly when you decide to do that in the style of the guy that you're doing it about, you know, it's like, wow, that's interesting. That's cool, you know.
You mentioned Moon. Wasn't that a similar situation where Duncan Jones had been using previous scores of yours? I feel like that.
Yeah,
he had said that.
Yeah, he had Requiem in the temp of that. Yeah.
So it's funny how these, you've written these scores which seem to embody some kind of feeling or emotion or theme, and then a like-minded filmmaker or a like-minded film will use that score for inspiration, and they may end up feeling like you're the only person who can do it. So it's interesting how these things seed then the next project.
Yeah, that happens. So I think that happens for a lot of composers, that they'll get a call because something of theirs is really working in a temp that somebody's doing, you know, and go, okay, well, this feels like the sensibility that we're looking for, you know.
So pivoting off that, can you talk about Mute at all? Have you finished scoring that?
I have finished scoring it, yes. Depends what you want to know. I don't know if there's anything I can't.
Do you know when it's coming out?
I don't.
Well, how was it working with Duncan again?
Great, easy. It really was. I mean, Duncan's a lovely guy, talented guy.
Did this feel more like a pure sort of free experience versus some of the ones where there's more of a corporate meddling?
Well, very much so. I mean, it literally was Duncan and I and his editor, Baz, and that was it. We you know, it's a Netflix film. Netflix don't really get involved. At least they didn't get involved with me, you know?
I think I've heard
and
that.
It was just me and Duncan really batting it around and, you know, exploring it. And once I got it to a place where Duncan was happy, I could then sort of riff a little bit, shall we say, not changing it, but just trying to find, for instance, it's set in Berlin, you know, in the future. And, you know, one of the first things obviously he mentioned was the fact that his dad had done so much classic work in Berlin. And he said he didn't want to avoid that. He didn't particularly want to reference it. He just was aware of it, you know. But I said to him, I said, well, you know, okay, let's take that. What was it that influenced his dad? You know, there's so much to sort of draw upon, you know, if you go from krautrock, as terrible a term as that is, or Kosmisch, or, you know, you're looking at Neu, Kraftwerk, Popol Vuh, you know, there's all sorts of stuff. They also had sort of like a German Schlager in there, which was basically, well, they had an American equivalent, stuff like Wayne Newton doing Danke Schön or something, which was like in the sort of early 50s, 60s, 70s, the bit like England, the mainstream music became almost like vaudeville and very light entertainment thing, you know. So you got this cross-section, a huge sort of varied palette of things you could go at, you know. Plus, as well, it's a vaguely science fiction film noir set in the future. So, you know, all bets are off, really. You can kind of explore to your heart's content.
So it sounds like it's not really stylistically or spiritually connected to Moon that much, based on sort of that description.
Well, it's set in the same universe, you know, and there's some stuff to enjoy from that side of things. But no, I mean, you know, I think it would work nicely as a companion piece, but it's a different story for sure.
The other director we most commonly associate you with is Darren Aronofsky, obviously. Mm-hmm. And there's a film in theaters now that does not carry a score by you. Is that just a brief kind of respite, or is that the end of a relationship, or is it too early to say?
Well, I mean, I think it's probably goes without saying that there's been some kind of hemorrhage in the relationship, you know. But, you know, these things happen. And, you know, I think Darren is, you know, I mean, I know there's, you know, obviously mother has divided a lot of people, but I think getting to make the film you want to make that is as, you know, confrontational as that sounds, I haven't seen it, it's got to be good, you know.
Will you see it?
I don't know. I might do. I'm interested. But I don't go to the theatre cinema very often. I would probably wait and watch it at home at some point.
Do you think there's a chance you'll work together again? I mean, is it too early to say?
Who knows? I mean, he didn't give me an explanation. You know what?
I don't have to go there.
Yeah, it's probably. I'd rather not talk about
That's
it because I, you know, it's sort of, I guess it is personal, but also as well, you know, we've worked together a long time, we've known each other a long time, and I certainly don't want to, you know, muddy that with saying things that could be misconstrued, or I just say them at the wrong time or something,
sure.
You know. So, I'm, you know, I'm glad he's doing his thing.
On a happier subject, you recently scored the Black Mirror episode San Junipero, mm-hmm. which just won an Emmy for Best TV Movie, and I think maybe another two.
I think Charlie got one for writing as well. Yeah, I it actually didn't come at a good time for me, and I didn't have a good time doing it at all, but that was nothing to do with it. That was to do with, you know, where I was at the time, and I'm sure I'd mentioned to you when we talked for the LA Times about my girlfriend dying, and,
right.
you know, and I was really struggling at that point because we were about to go and do these shows, and the final show we were doing was the one that I'd had to cancel when Heather got sick. So I knew going back and doing that show was going to be, you know, it had been like 18 months since she'd died at that point, I think, and going to do those shows sort of really, not that it had gone away, but it really brought it to the fore, you know, and I was doing Black Mirror, and I just was wasn't really in great shape. Mentally, personally, but Owen, the director, and Charlie, the producer, were cool. You know, I mean, me and Owen did a sort of. I mean, Owen was sort of saying like it's sort of John Hughes. You know, John Hughes. And I go, well, yeah, I know, but I'm not exactly the John Hughes guy. You know, but I did my take on it, shall we say? And Owen thought it was too dark, so we dialed it back a little bit. And then when Charlie heard it, he's going like, what's this? It's like John Hughes. It's not dark enough, you know. So we sort of had to find some middle ground, which I guess, you know, that's the process, you know.
Yeah.
But I was, like I said, I wasn't in a great place, and the episode is so different from other Black Mirror episodes that I was thinking, man, I don't think people are going to like this.
The only one with a happy ending.
Yeah, I was saying, like, this doesn't seem like it's going to fly at all. And I'd finished it, delivered it. I'd gone on tour. Started working on Loving Vincent, and then Black Mirror was coming out, and suddenly this episode exploded, and people wanted to release the score. I hadn't even done like stereo mixes of the score because
an episode of a TV show.
Yeah, I didn't think it was ever going to get to that place, you know. So that was we scrambled and did the mixes and the arrangement. Yeah, and it just seemed to really capture people's imagination. It was amazing. I mean. Brilliant as well, because you don't know what's going to capture people's attention, you know?
Do you feel like the state of mind you were in, the emotional state of mind you were in, is in the score? Do you hear it in the score?
I mean, partly because, you know, I mean, it's about death and what's next and loss again, you know. So it was undeniably, you know, weighing on me. And you know, I mean, I think, well, if it's not in there, then when the hell is something going to be in there? Because, you know, I think about this a lot because of, you know, I write a lot of music. And I'm going like, well, yeah, you can write, but like, when does it actually become something special? Because, you know, inspiration can't be there all the time. You can't, surely, I mean, not every time you sit down and go, like, oh, I'm inspired, it's amazing, you know. You've got to have these, surely, peaks and troughs of creativity, of connection to what you're doing, you know. So when it does happen, I've got to feel that it's got to be part of it, you know. It's got to be the fact that I've got in there and it's got something out of me, I think. You can't necessarily hope that other people are going to feel that, but you can only really speak for yourself, you know. I think that's part of the reason why I'm not so interested in people's responses to my work outside of the people that I'm working with. Because, you know, it's actually, you know, Darren was the person who said to me years ago, you know, that not everybody's going to like what you do, but they can see what you've done and you can be proud and know that you've done what you set out to do, you know. And that to me is like, That's success, if you like. You know, everything on top of that is like gravy. You know, people liking it, people buying it, millions of people seeing it and listening to it, whatever. That's all wonderful. You can't legislate for that. You can only legislate for the first part where you do something that you connect with and you're proud of yourself. You know.
I think one of the reasons I really respond to your film work is because I really hear an author. I hear a voice. And I've gotten really tired of film music where you don't hear authorship.
Right.
Where it is just regurgitated tropes, or, you know, it's clearly just sort of modeled after 1,000 other scores, or it's playing it so safe that you don't hear any single voice behind it. And I always hear a voice in your scores. And then
thank you.
On top of that, you keep gravitating back towards these themes of loss and death and sadness, which is sort of my sweet spot for art.
Right. Mine too, really. You know? I mean, I can only look at it in as I have a different idea of what my role is within film composition compared to other guys. I mean, I'm sure we're probably all quite different, you know. I never feel really the need or the desire even to do anything other than what I want to do. I know that's incredibly arrogant. and you know, as a team player, as a collaborator within a big production like a film, whether it's a small film or a big film, it's still a huge ordeal. But the way I sort of justify that is going like, well, you know, you've come to me for a certain thing and I will help you get that if we're simpatico and we're on the same page. But, you know, don't come to me if you, like I say, you know, you need Fast and the Furious 8 or Transformers or whatever those type of films are. I couldn't even tell you what the score is in those. But don't come to me, having heard what I do, and think that I'm... When I first started, I thought, like, composers are like, you know, well, a bit of reggae, yeah, here we go, a bit of jazz, fine. But you know what? No. I mean, you know, if you want some reggae, go get a guy who does reggae, man, you know, or jazz. I do my thing, you know. I don't believe that I should be like a jack of all trades and, you know, I can just dial in a bit of anything you want. And I say it's arrogant, but I'm going, well, it's my life. It's my music I want to write. I'm going to be inspired by this. If I'm not honest to that, then what am I doing, you know?
And to find filmmakers like Duncan or the Loving Vincent filmmakers who are on board with that, who come to you because they want that, is maybe it's a rare thing. Maybe there aren't too many of them out there, but it's nice that you found people who want that from you and expect that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we want more voices, you know. When I first met Darren, we bonded more over the music we hated than the music we liked, you know. We describe film music at that point as wallpaper, you know. It seemed to have no character. We gravitated towards John Carpenter, you know, and it's very noticeable, shall we say. You know, these you have these people that say, you know, the best scores, you can have the ones you don't notice, you know, which is absolutely fine, but why does there only have to be one sort of score, you know? I mean, that just is crazy to me. It's not one sort of film, it's not one sort of book.
So what are you working on right now?
well, having said all that, nothing. No, I'm very much at a transitional point of my own, to be honest. I'm not really sure that I got much more in me in at the moment. I probably just need a long break. I'm really interested in doing something in the theatre. I'd like to do something live music-wise in theatre if I could get an opportunity. I'd like to maybe step away from film for a little while.
That might be good for your soul.
Yeah, I just want to, you know, I want some different... don't get me wrong, I'm sure there'll be plenty of challenges and annoyances in other things, but it'd just be nice to try something different and feel something different.
Well, I hope you find something that speaks to you.
Yeah, I do too.
Loving Vincent opens at Limley's Royal Theatre in Los Angeles on Friday. Clinton Mansell's soundtrack is available on iTunes and in other digital stores now. For more out-and-about coverage of the creative communities of Southern California, visit kusc.org/out-and-about. Thanks for listening. I'm Tim Grieving.